Folks, this is August from the Queer Core podcast. This story coming up, this three-part series, is our most ambitious piece of work to date. It's about one woman versus the world and her mighty feat in participating in the creation of the LGBTQ+ rainbow flag. Such a happy event has had such a sad ending until now. But when I dig my heels into something, I am go, go, go. There are many people in this story, but one of the most important is Lynn Segerbloom, aka Fairy Argyle Rainbow. Who is that, you may ask? She's the mother of the rainbow flag. Why don't we know her? Why has her story been muted? Let's get into it.
The actual designer, and I am the dyer, and I actually sewed part of it too.
Was their symbol. It wasn't planned. It was organic.
Just a heads up, all of the different interviews featured were recorded with various mediums, such as Zoom, a microphone to my phone on speaker, and a tape-recorded call. Bear with us with these different audio qualities, but regardless, the content is heavy-hitting and ready to go. Now, what's the deal with rainbows? Well, throughout human history, rainbows have mystified and inspired, a greeting of light and serenity contrasting the darkness and chaos of a storm. They have symbolized hope, peace, and the mysteries of existence. They are a touch of the divine. For a moment, we can see the invisible structure, the body of the light made visible, a secret revealed, then hidden again. Though it may seem like a modern phenomenon, the rainbow flag has waved throughout history. In the early Reformation period, the German theologian Thomas Münzer used a flag bearing a rainbow in his preaching. In 1525, that flag was used in the German Peasants' War as a symbol of societal change. For those religious peasants, that rainbow represented a new beginning and contact with God. In the Bible, God sent a rainbow to Noah as a promise that the world would never flood again. Later, in the 18th century, the English-American revolutionary and author Thomas Paine advocated for the adoption of the rainbow flag as a universal symbol for identifying neutral ships at sea. In the 19th century, Buddhists in Sri Lanka flew rainbow flags to unify their faith. Even now, people in India fly rainbow flags every January 31st to commemorate the passing of the spiritual leader Meher Baba. Rainbow flags have been flown internationally by members of the peace movement since 1961, and the Peruvian city of Cusco, the gateway of Machu Picchu, officially made its flag the rainbow flag in the 1970s. But now, throughout the world, rainbow flags are primarily known as a symbol for the LGBTQ+ community. A community of different colors, backgrounds, and orientations united together, bringing light and joy to the world. A forever symbol of where we started, where we have come, and where we need to go. When many of us see a rainbow flag flowing in the wind, we know we are safe and free. The LGBTQ rainbow flag we're discussing today, our flag, the world's flag, was born in San Francisco in 1978. Let's set up Fairy Argyle Rainbow, aka Lynn's rainbow journey. Lynn was originally from the North Shore of Hawaii and moved to San Francisco when she attended art school at the Academy of Art. She grew up in an abusive family, and shortly after she moved to San Francisco, she joined the Angels of Light, a free theater performance troupe where the members had to return to the alternative hippie lifestyle and deny credit for their works. She was escaping an abusive household looking for a life beyond the suburbs.
When did you move to San Francisco, and how did living a life with so much traveling growing up and experiencing so much prepare you for San Francisco?
I was in high school and I got this scholarship for the summer to the Academy of Art. on Sutter Street in San Francisco. My art teacher encouraged me to enter the contest, put my artwork in there, and I won. But I was only 16, so my mom wouldn't let me go. So then the next year, I entered the contest again for a summer scholarship to the Academy of Art again, and I won again. So then my girlfriend, Jane, who was a year older, said she would come with me and go to, you know, the summer school there. So we went together. So then my mom let me go to San Francisco for the summer for art school, and I was 17.
While money and tech interests rule the city now, in the 1960s and 70s, San Francisco was a wonderland for low and no income artists. It was the center of counterculture. By the mid-1970s, the Haight-Ashbury neighborhood that had once been a psychedelic playground of hippie art, culture, and music had fallen into disarray. Hard, dangerous drugs like heroin had replaced the mind-expanding psychedelics. The young queers and artists needed a new home, and they found that new home in the Castro District. Here's Lee Mentley, a main mover in this impossible but true story. He ran the gay center where the first LGBTQ rainbow flags were created.
Basically, the Cockettes and a lot of the artists had moved into Castro Street to get away from all of the stuff that had happened in the Haight. You know, they had all been living, you know, the flower child life in Haight-Ashbury. But once all the heavy drugs and the heroin and all the violence moved into the Haight, they came over to Castro Street because, you know, I mean, the rents were amazing. I had a 14-room Victorian flat for $185 a month.
Wow.
So it was easy, you know, for us to move in. And then the landlord started really liking us because we improved the property. You know, and so they were more interested in having more gay people move in.
Do you think gay people make neighborhoods more livable?
Of course.
Lee Mentley was born in 1948. He knew he was different from a very young age.
Well, again, I was born in Erie, Pennsylvania. By the age of 4, my mother called me her princess. Huh. And she called me her little Lorraine.
Did she, like, make you gay, or did you already express
No. She would have preferred, in the long run, she really wanted grandchildren so bad. But my mother was such a loving woman. She just didn't have a racist or discriminatory bone in her body. And she kept always thinking, and some of my other friends always thought, that I'd grow out of it. That was sort of the thing that in the 50s, right, in the early 60s, people would say, oh, you'll grow out of it, you know.
Lee arrived in San Francisco in 1972 and quickly fell in with the oddball artists and performers in the Castro District. Donning flamboyant genderfuck clothes, performing avant-garde theater, and creating their own clubhouses.
We sort of lived in our, what we would call, you know, sort of like when people were voguing, they would say things were the house of this or the house of that. And the different Victorian flats were different artists, you know, moved in, or pocket people moved in, it would be known as Goldie Glitter's Mansion, or our flat was called the Hula Palace.
Let's set up Lynn's rainbow journey. While she was already the tie-dye queen at this point in her life, she made her first flags for Bethany, the Princess of Argyle, who had a theater troupe for children called the Moment Museum. Bethany's boyfriend needed to spruce up his houseboat, and so they called Lynn asking if she could lend a hand.
I was living at this big houseboat, Alan Watts Houseboat in Sausalito, when I met this man who said, do I need seamstresses or people who can make flags? She's living in San Francisco somewhere, or staying somewhere, and I meet up with her. I go meet her and say, can you make 33 green flags for this man for this much money? And she worked out the deal, and she got paid, and she did it.
Entrenched in the free-loving Technicolor world of the 1970s San Francisco, Lynn took on her new name, a new name, the new name, Fairy Argyle Rainbow. Now's the time that we talk about the forces working against her, though. Now, this is heavy, important, and we cannot gloss over the details with rosy-colored glasses. While we don't speak ill of the dead, part of the reason that Lynn's story is so underdocumented and has caused pain to her is because of a man named Gilbert Baker.
And this is where I had my arguments and my fights with Gilbert Baker. And if you go through all of his different interviews, you see that his story changes over and over and over again. He even got to the point where he said, well, Harvey Milk came to me and asked me to create a symbol for the movement. No, Harvey didn't do no such thing at all. We had no idea that the rainbow flag was going to become our symbol. It was something the community accepted, and it was something that over 150 different artists worked on. And that's what's powerful. What's powerful is community.
Gilbert Baker has claimed he was the sole, quote, creator of the rainbow flag. There ain't no way that this grassroots and poor homo historian is going to open himself up to getting sued, so I'm choosing my words carefully. You can make up your own minds as we continue to tell the story, but I'm just laying out the facts. In an interview, Gilbert said, I think I named her Fairy Argyle Rainbow. Wrong. Who named her? Bethany, the Princess of Argyle, of course. At this special time in San Francisco, queens and princesses could collide and create magic. Bethany would walk around San Francisco's Castro district and name people. As simple as that. Well, here's Bethany again.
I'm the Princess of Argyle. That's Fairy Argyle Rainbow. I was naming everybody at that time. Gary Guitar was Gary Maynard. I named all the neighborhood clown was Paul O'Driscoll. Okay, Princess of Argyle, of course, that's my name. Now we have Fairy Argyle Rainbow, because she's rainbowing all of us. She's a fairy and she's an Argyle. There you go.
Well, it used to be on her driver's license. Her driver's license was Fairy Argyle Rainbow.
Okay.
Now her real name is Lynn Sagerblum.
Uh-huh. How did you get your driver's license changed?
You just showed up at the DMV and filled out the form with your new name, Fairy Argyle Rainbow. They didn't ask you for a birth certificate. And you just said, this is your name now. And they gave me a driver's license that said Fairy Argyle Rainbow.
Simply put, many of Gilbert Baker's claims have not been consistent. And it's interesting to see what his estate changes and removes from the World Wide Web the more I scream Lynn's story. In Gilbert Baker's book, which we will discuss more later, he doesn't acknowledge her full name. He calls her Fairy Argyle and strategically removes the name Rainbow. We'd like to take a quick commercial break to thank our sponsor. Oh wait, we don't have one and we need one. The Queer Core podcast features my archival interviews. I have over 1,100 files and we have the content to take everything as it relates to gay history and academia to the next level. We need help. Patrons, companies, individuals with a few extra bucks, please go to lgbtqhp.org. You can donate or inquire within. We'll plug your product. We'll write a short and snappy advert. We have you covered. Now, back to Lynn.
How did you meet Lee Mentley?
That was at the first Castro Street Fair, and that was the first one. It was by word of mouth. People came and set up their wares, or just came with food to sell, or just came, you know, to be there. And there was music and dancing and food, and it was a festival. But it was, you know, it was free. So, because this is all just word of mouth.
And I think it was around 1971, I ran into Lee Mentley on the street. And we talked, and I thought, you know, what an interesting fellow. He's kind of bizarre looking and odd and very intelligent. And we started to see each other on the street and, you know, in the Castro periodically. We became friends. Then at that time, Lee was living in what later on became called the Hula Palace, which wasn't quite that way yet. At that point in time, it was just basically, you know, a huge flat with a bunch of gay men living there.
The voice you just heard was John Sirian, an artist and poet who, after moving penniless to San Francisco, found himself involved with 330 Grove and the original Rainbow Flags. Inspired by the work of activists in Los Angeles like Don Kilhefner, who we interviewed last season, episode 3, wink wink, in 1977, Lee and a community of activists opened one of the city's first LGBTQ centers called the Gay Community Center at 330 Grove Street. On the spacious top floor, Lee opened an art gallery and called it the Top Floor Gallery.
And it was the building that was directly behind MoMA in San Francisco. And that's where we did the Black Mountain exhibit. And I think, oh my God, how did I do this? I mean, I can barely get to the store today, let alone be involved in, you know, so many things all at once. You know, from being Hula Palace, the Top Floor Gallery, the Gay Community Center, I was on the board of directors of over 30 organizations.
Before it became the Gay Center, 330 Grove had already become a place where history was made. In the late 1960s and 1970s, the building housed the Black Panthers and the Gay Liberation Front, and also the Angels of Light, the theater troupe that Lynn was a part of. Patty Hearst was also allegedly held hostage at 330 Grove.
There was a dance company that used 330 Grove as a dance studio. It was a Black dance company, and they called themselves Black Light Explosion. But it was a cover for letting in Black Panthers. And they organized and did things in the basement there, and the SLA hid Patty Hearst there.
Really?
This building has a huge history. I mean, all the way back for the first drag performance at 330 Grove was Ginsberg.
Wow.
Because in the 60s, it was the rehearsal place for Janis Joplin and Big Brother and Holding Company and the Jefferson Airplane, and because it was right around, you know, a block and a half from the Fillmore.
With its formal recognition as the Gay Center, a strong community of artists and activists began forming around 330 Grove.
The Hula Palace on the Castro became the hub of a subatomic nuclear explosion magic at the highest possible level. It was almost like reincarnation every moment.
And God bless my friend Bethany Argyle. Bethany was involved in this too. She was coming and going. She wasn't actually involved in the flag itself, but in the whole community going on. When they came in the room, it was like they were throwing glitter up in the air.
I did sleep there a couple of times, yes. In between apartments, I did sleep at 330 Grove, up in the top floor gallery.
Lynn, aka Fairy Argyle Rainbow, who had been making costumes for theater and everyday life in the Castro, rented a space at the top floor gallery at 330 Grove to continue her work. Among the other artists swirling in and out of the center were James McNamara, a talented seamster and clothing designer, and a flamboyant young activist and artist named Gilbert Baker. Born in Chanute, Kansas in 1951, Baker served in the United States Army from 1970 to 1972, where he was stationed as a medic in San Francisco until he was honorably discharged. Baker drifted into the newly formed queer community and befriended Harvey Milk, who in 1977 became the first openly gay person to be elected to public office in California when he won a seat on the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. Paul Langlotz, James McNamara's best friend, remembers the three of them together, hippies running free.
We had always been outcasts, like in our own culture, like in New Jersey. You know, James and I were hippie boys. You see pictures of me as a kid, I have hair down to here. And in San Francisco, I had long hair for a long time and a nose ring. And, you know, we were part of the alternative crowd, the more transgressive crowd. we weren't like the standard gay boys and the standard gay boys. The lesbians were a more unique community in those days. They were more radical than we were. They were more politically astute. In a way, they were stronger. They were outrageous. So really, we were just layabouts. We were artists. James wanted to be a fashion designer. Gilbert wanted to be, you know, queen of the world. And Lynn was very simple. You know, Lynn was a simple artist. She was a fabric artist. Her work was beautiful. She wasn't, she didn't have grand designs. You know, we were all looking for ways to live and to make money and to not be trapped in, you know, 9-to-5 jobs.
A year after the Gay Community Center opened, history was made. None of the civil rights warriors we have featured in the Queer Core podcast have acted alone. No revolution has ever been won with an army of one. Behind every strong activist, there is a community willing to lend themselves to their common cause. Producing 2 40-by-60-foot rainbow flags was no different. In May 1978, the San Francisco Pride community met at the Gay Community Center at 330 Grove to decide what they should do for this year's Pride March, then known as Gay Freedom Day. The year's theme was Come Out with Joy, Speak Out for Justice. Pride was all about being visible, saying, I'm here, I'm queer, get out of my way. It was a revolutionary act in itself. More than just a fun visual companion to the protest, decorations were a way for LGBTQ people to amplify their message, to strengthen their voices, and to become even more visible. With her knowledge of fabric and dyeing, Lynn was asked to be on the decorating committee, along with McNamara and Baker. If you have been to San Francisco, then you know June gloom is a real thing. San Francisco in June is often gray and drenched in fog that sweeps the streets. While deliberating the decorations for that year, Lynn said she suggested her favorite symbol, the rainbow, as a way of brightening up the gray San Francisco Civic Center where the Pride celebrations would culminate.
And she came to 330 Grove one day with a couple of her friends, Jonathan and Robert, and said that she thought we should make rainbow flags for Gay Day to brighten up City Hall and Civic Center because it's all gray and cold in June in San Francisco.
You know, Lee remembers us having a meeting about the flags when I presented the idea of the flags. But at that meeting, there were just a handful of people, and all I can remember is Lee, and Lee has assured me that Gilbert was not at that meeting. I don't know where he was because, you know, I just couldn't keep track of him. But he was not at the meeting where I suggested rainbow flags, and we decided, yes, that sounds great. And I probably had some sketches. Of course I probably did. I just wish I had them now. You know, things get lost when you move about so much. And also, this was a long time ago. Record keeping isn't what it is today. You know, it's not like you had a cell phone, you could just take a picture of it and email it to, you know, the committee.
The day that that happened, I got called down to the office at the Pride Foundation. And the Pride Foundation, it was a legal foundation with about 35, 37 attorneys that worked on issues relating to gay rights. And then it had it ran the Gay Community Center at 330 Grove, and it had other standing committees. I believe it was 78, 79, the Gay Freedom Day Parade Committee became a standing committee of the Pride Foundation in order for them to receive tax-exempt funding so that they could receive city funds. On that committee, Gilbert Baker and Lynn Sagerblum, known at that time as Fairy Argyle Rainbow, were the co-chairs of the decorating committee. My position, I was on the executive board of the Pride Foundation, but on the top floor of 330 Grove was a 10,000 square foot art gallery called Top Floor Gallery. Lynn and her friend Jonathan, I believe his name was, and Robert Gutman went in to talk to Paul Hardman with this idea about creating the rainbow flags. But there wasn't a budget for it because the money that the city had given to the parade committee didn't include funds for a large project like this. So Paul Hardman, who was president of Pride, called me down from, and Jimmy Coker down from the gallery, and we sat and listened to Lynn and Robert tell us about this concept, this idea of creating rainbow flags.
Upcoming is 2 cents from Adrian Brooks, who is one of the main scriptwriters and actors in the Angels of Light, the free theater performance troupe where members had to deny credit for their work. Lynn, aka Fairy Argyle Rainbow, was also a member, as you may remember.
Yeah.
To use a sewing machine. James McNamara attended the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York, which is one of the most prestigious organizations of its kind. He did not learn to use a sewing machine from Gilbert Baker. Gilbert Baker was the lazy sod. Lee can confirm he had to be pushed to show up to do anything at all. And what he did was so some on the flag. I don't know that for a fact. I was there. I saw the thing being made, but Gilbert was not somebody that I paid attention to. He was not worth it. There were great, great people involved at that time, and there were tremendous, forceful, brave, brave people. But as you can see, if you Google Gilbert Baker and Barack Obama in the Oval Office, there he is presenting Barack Obama with Lynn's design.
And here is Paul Langlotz.
And see, one of the things about James was, James knew how to sew. So he, when we were in high school, he would make all my clothes. I mean, it was, you know, it was great. But the trick was with James is that he could do welt seams. And welt seams, you know, are those seams on the inside of your blue jeans, the ones that they overlap. It's what makes blue jeans so strong. So they have this series of overlapping layers that are sewed together. And so that's how they sewed the flag together. And that was one of the things that was so important about the construction of the flag, was that James knew how to do that.
And then, of course, we have Gilbert Baker, who claimed he liked the song Somewhere Over the Rainbow, and that fucking inspired him.
I read online that Gilbert called you after because he knew you could help with organic dye, so he called you about the project.
That's a lie. And the dyes, although they're not toxic dyes, they are not organic dyes. They're for cotton, silk, linen, and rayon. So only natural fiber dyes is what they are. They're called Procyon dyes, and they'll be different labels on them. But the like, it's like if I said laundry detergent, it's a heading. Procyon dyes, it's a heading. So you can only dye cotton, silk, linen, and rayon with these dyes. If you want to dye nylon, you're going to have to use a different kind of dye. And one time I dyed polyester, and that's really toxic. And after that, I never wanted to try it again. That was really bad. And you're supposed to wear a gas mask.
What initially drew you to preserving this story?
It's a good question. Question. Thank you for asking it. I've always been drawn to underdogs, for one thing. And I really, really hate lies. Nonetheless, the issue of a woman being ripped off, denied her voice, having her work taken over and claimed by a gay white man is just so disgusting to me.
I asked Paul why talking about his friends and their lack of credit makes him so emotional.
The truth is not enough. And so with all this stuff about James literally not getting credit for sewing these fucking flags together is just basically infuriating to me. And for Lynn not getting credit, I mean, the work that she put into dyeing those flags, I mean, hand dyeing those fuckers, you know, lugging this shit up to the roof of Grove Street and then, you know, dyeing the stripes and rinsing them out and then bringing them to the laundromat to dry them. And then James sewing the fucking thing together. And for people not to understand or believe that they were the Betsy Rosses of the flag, to me, is it just infuriating. It's unjust.
James McNamara never got any credit. And by far, he far out-sewed, out-maneuvered, out-helped. If without James, we couldn't have got those done on time. You know, it was really hard to figure out how many yards of this do we have to dye? Now, how many more yards do we need? Are we short on this? This stripe, you know, do we have enough?
It's unjust, so very, very unjust, and that's why we're talking about it here at the Queer Core Podcast. Thank you for listening to part one of our three-part series on the secret origins of the LGBTQ rainbow flag, One Woman Versus the World. Part two is coming at you hot in 2 weeks, so get ready and prepare yourself now. My name is August, and I'm the host of the Queer Core Podcast. The Queer Core Podcast is produced by David Newtown and features my silky smooth narrations and archival recordings. This series also features the work of Chris Coase, who helps us with the script and research. You can follow us on Instagram at the LGBTQ History Project and visit our website at queercorepod.com. Our theme song is courtesy of Silke Berlin and The Addictions, and additional music is courtesy of Blue Dot Sessions. Until we speak again, peace out.